playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. The presidential election campaign officially kicked off on Wednesday afternoon. Six candidates in the field and less than a month to go before polling on Friday the 26th of October. On Drive Time, Mary Wilson hopped on the merry-go-round, conducting what can only be described as speed dating with the presidential contenders. A six-minute face-to-face with the incumbent, Michael D. Higgins, with Sinn Féin's Leonie Riada, Senator Joan Freeman, and TV dragons Sean Gallagher, Gavin Duffy and Peter Casey, all laying out their stalls for the big job. Mary Wilson began by asking Michael D. Higgins about the unvouched annual allowance of €317,000, details of which emerged at the Public Accounts Committee on Tuesday. She wondered if you could explain how the money was spent.
Let me be very clear that it isn't an allowance to me. It's an allowance to the work of the presidency. It came into being 80 years ago, 1938, when Douglas Hyde was established as the first Cé Dochtúir an Éireann. It was changed a number of times, but the change that matters, it was changed in 1998, and that is when the figure of 317 was established, and it hasn't been changed since then. It is not sought by the president. It isn't decided by the president. It is, in fact, voted as a sum by the Oireachtas. They could change it if they wished, but insofar as how is it spent? It is spent, in fact, on the 20,000 visitors that go through the Oireachtas every year, including the afternoon teas we have for senior citizens, the 8 garden parties, the garden parties that include, for example, celebrating the suffragettes, the Magdalene, victims of the Magdalene.
That all has to come out of that
317,000. That comes out of that 317. And indeed, at the end of the term, anything that is underspent goes straight back to government.
Are you surprised that it is an unvouched allowance and that the Budget Audit Committee of the Presidency didn't sit at all between 2014 and last year and has now sat, I think, on three occasions?
Well, first of all, it is not my function as President to be doing the work of the Secretary General to the President or the Secretary General to the government. Of course, there were circumstances. I watched the debate in the Public Accounts Committee, but you will appreciate that I honour and respect the independence of the other houses of the Oireachtas. But if you didn't want to serve a cup of tea to those elderly citizens, if you didn't want to receive the Magdalene victims, if you didn't want to receive those, for example, who are associated with the Irish language movement, all the different voluntary bodies that Sabine and I have ran garden parties for, you could stop it by a vote in the Oireachtas by saying you want the president to be out there receiving nobody, doing nothing, but occasionally signing a paper that you wanted to him or her to sign.
All right.
Michael D. Higgins with Mary Wilson. Well, Dragons' Den star Sean Gallagher was runner-up to President Higgins 7 years ago in controversial circumstances. Since that time, the country has undergone massive economic and social change with same-sex marriage and abortion referendums, a bank bailout, recession, a housing crisis, a health crisis. Mary Wilson wondered where he'd been this past 7 years in terms of leadership.
My point to you was, why have you stayed an outsider? Why haven't you come in?
I have not been an outsider. I have worked in business. I have worked championing small businesses. I have worked in community. I've worked in charity. But to be clear, bringing forward legislation and supporting that, that doesn't happen. It takes hundreds, possibly thousands of hours.
Why the presidency? Why not Dáil Éireann? Why not Shannadairn? Why not the European Parliament at a time of Brexit?
I think that I'm very happy and well placed to draw my skills over a lifetime of commitment to small business, to rural Ireland, to charities, to communities, all of those things, the areas of disability.
But why the presidency?
I think the presidency is an important role, and I outlined that in 2011, and I'm as equally committed to Ireland. More so now, my resolve has been strengthened. Now that I'm a parent, I look at this differently. It's about shaping an Ireland. And I think the challenges now facing us are different from 7 years ago. Weeks after the last presidential election, I wrote to the then Taoiseach, Enda Kenny, and to the Taoiseach, and to the then Minister for Enterprise and Employment, Richard Bruton. And I offered my energies to the government to help work with them to address the challenges that Ireland was facing.
What did they say?
I got no response.
You got no response.
So for the next 18, but just to be clear, for the next 18 months after stepping forward for the office of president, my phone did not ring for 18 months. So I began to rebuild my own life. I began to start a family, and I began to put my family and my single responsibility.
Family first,
and then business, and then business. And I have been working actively, as you know, writing for the Sunday Independent. I've been promoting business. So trying to rebuild their areas.
In 2011, people knew you. You were prominent on Dragon's Den. That's a long time ago. Those recent referendums we mentioned earlier has seen the emergence of new young voters. They don't know you. They were children back in 2011. How are you going to reach them? Do you know what matters to them?
I spend a considerable amount of my time, not in public, but in schools and in colleges and in universities, speaking to students, helping encourage them not just to talk about business and careers, but to help them build resilience. As a former youth worker, I spent a number of years writing the government's first alcohol and drug education programme. That was a life skills programme for young people. What young people need now, they need the ability to learn, to unlearn and to relearn. They need the skills of confidence, of self-esteem,
of
self-belief.
Can you give them that from Áras an Uachtaráin?
I think we can by leadership.
Sean Gallagher. Well, the following day, Thursday, four of the six candidates were back on air for the first debate of the campaign, hosted by Áine Lawler on the News at One. Gavin Duffy, Leonie Riada, Joan Freeman and Peter Casey. President Higgins and Sean Gallagher didn't take part, but sent their excuses. The discussion was wide-ranging, the presidential salary, Donald Trump, the Irish language, unification, and Áine Lawler also raised the issue of campaign funding with Joan Freeman.
You spoke yesterday about the 317,000 expenses allowance to Áras an Uachtaráin that was discussed at the Public Accounts Committee. You say you want greater transparency. As a candidate, though, when are you going to show transparency about the donors who have contributed to your campaign and to naming who they are?
So first of all, I am only transparent, and I was waiting for permission from the two donors, from in fact the two business people who gave me a loan. First of all, one of them is called Des Walsh. He's a retired businessman from LA in America. I haven't yet received permission from the second person.
And Des Walsh gave you a loan or a donation of how much?
A loan.
How much?
Of 120,000. Can I just comment on that, though? You know, we're talking about my transparency. We're also talking about funding this campaign. I haven't arrived here today with big buses. I'm not aligned to any party. I am the last true independent person that can represent this country, because the next election will be about being aligned to parties or having the money to campaign.
Joan Freeman. Well, Sinn Féin candidate Leonie Riada arrived in RTE in a big battle bus. She defended not putting her party's logo on her campaign posters, saying that she's proud to be a Sinn Féin candidate, but insisted that the presidency should be above party politics. And then that HPV vaccine question that keeps following her around.
All parents care about the privacy of their children, and I don't want to intrude on yours. On the other hand, if you're a president of the people, don't the voters need to know that you are living what you preach and not just preaching support for the HPV vaccine? And that's why I've asked you that question.
Firstly, Áine, your facts are absolutely wrong, because I never opposed the vaccination. I was always in favour of it. What I was simply doing
you
was
wrote
raising,
to the school?
No, I raised concerns about the lack of information. I never actually was on record saying I opposed it. So it's good
Cork
to get back.
Cork 96 FM in 2016 and on
that,
Facebook.
If you listen back to that, you will hear me saying I am raising concerns about the lack of information. No time did I say I was against it.
You wrote to
and
their
I
school.
And I am completely... Sorry?
You wrote to their school?
I didn't write to their school at all. I don't know where you're getting your information from. I was looking, as any parent would be concerned about what you're going to inject into any of your children. You want the full facts. That's all I was raising.
We have
and
had a huge
then,
issue
since
over
then,
the...
I over, completely yes. in favour of it.
And we have had a huge issue. And again, this is why it's important to raise this question. We've seen women out there encouraging politicians all over the country to fully back screening. You are saying publicly you back screening. Is your family living that backing for the HPV vaccine? And should people not know that about you as a presidential contender?
As I said, I am fully in favour of the vaccine, and I fully support and endorse, and I think it's very brave what Vicky Phelan and Eminic Bohuna have done. I've seen cancer up close myself, so anybody that can promote a vaccine to prevent such horrendous ravages on anybody has to be supported and promoted. However, I don't think it's fair that journalists and others like them, there's almost a sinister element that they're looking and hounding my children's private medical records. They are private, they are underage, there is data protection, and I think any parent parent in this country would be in agreement of that, that they would say our children's medical records are sacred. They are right to their privacy.
I merely raised it because it is a public issue and you had in fact spoken about
it. But let me clarify, I am
publicly
completely in support of the vaccine, Áine.
Leonie Riada. Well, businessman Peter Casey said it was a total disgrace that President Higgins and Sean Gallagher hadn't taken part in the debate. He described Donald Trump as a serial womaniser, but said he'd welcome him to Ireland. And he was again questioned about his stance on neutrality.
The President is Commander-in-Chief of the Defence Forces and we're a neutral state. And as recently as last night, you were talking about your support for Ireland joining the NATO military alliance. And I know you said that as President, if you were elected, you wouldn't talk in such a way again. But do those views not disqualify you to be the Commander-in-Chief of the Defence Forces of a neutral nation whose neutrality is recognised in EU protocols, in agreements all over the place?
You know, we are protected by NATO, essentially. When the Russian jets flew around Ireland there, it was the British jets that got up and dispatched them off. So, you know, it's disingenuous to say that we have got a defence force that can defend ourselves. We have, but it's basically the American and the NATO that defends us. It's an outdated concept of neutrality is that, you know, we have got... We're not at war anymore. If we were, then it would
And those are your views. But the question was, holding those views and the public knowing, because you've stated them again there now, that those are your those views, does that not disqualify you to lead the armed forces of a neutral state?
Absolutely not. I mean, the president is not in charge of the day-to-day management of the forces, but he is the commander of the armed forces. And that was put into place in case the government went rogue and the army has loyalty to the president.
Should the president not also represent our neutrality?
I raised the issue. I don't think neutrality in this day and age is relevant. I think that we, as a nation, if we want good defence, we have to pay for it. And I think we should pay, like Greece does, pay our 2%.
Peter Casey. Well, when it came to his turn, businessman and Dragon's Den judge Gavin Duffy said if elected, he'd take a presidential salary at a level agreed by the government. He said the presidency shouldn't be an exclusive club confined to rich people like Peter Casey, who'd earlier said he'd waive the salary. And Gavin Duffy also reiterated the need for a youth corps to volunteer abroad.
Gavin Duffy, you've spoken about your idea for a youth corps where young Irish adults would go abroad and do developmental work. Is that right?
Yes, I have. Yes.
On that, aid agencies have in the past, I mean, there have been all kinds of records of kids going off on gap years and, you know, doing various things. Aid agencies have come up with the word voluntourism. It's not always particularly what developing countries need. Is that a bright idea aimed at what's good for Irish kids, but not at what is really good for developing countries?
But it's interesting that this proposal of mine seems to be the one that's resonating most, and all of the media questions are usually around it, and certainly in the council chambers around the country. I think I spoke to 14 councils. It seemed to be the idea.
But
that
whether it's a good idea or not,
it's
whether it's really
idea,
what developing countries need.
It's a great idea. Now, you know, somebody can coin a phrase like you're saying, voluntourism, and take away from it. Ireland is changing. And, you know, in the past, Irish people were famous for going abroad, be it, you know, with a missionary zeal to contribute to the developing parts of the world. And the young people of today are very, very keen to do that. And I believe an Ireland International Youth Corps for 18 to 25 year olds to join it, to do 3 months of service at home in their community, and then to do a tour of duty abroad, volunteering, building an irrigation
system. And funded
how? Well, we spend about $900 million a year on international aid. So a slight fraction of that would get us a better return on our investment, where we would have people abroad. They return home then with their CV enhanced. This is what I did for my community. This is how I contributed to the developing world. I believe it is something that we seriously have to consider. And during my term in the 7 years, by the time we'd be finished, it'd be up, fully running and a real success.
Gavin Duffy. So very little fire and fury, just a few below the belt comments from that first presidential debate on the News at One with Áine Lawler on Thursday. Well, journalist Ellen Coyne of the Times Ireland was tuned into that broadcast. She gave her reaction to Sean O'Rourke yesterday.
What do you think of it so far? I mean, Peter Casey, not pulling his punches, landed one props on Michael Dee yesterday by suggesting that his number of public engagements had halved.
I think that Peter is adopting a kind of entertainer slash mudslinger role in this campaign, and I'm not sure how well that's going to work for him so far. I think just a couple of days in, looking at the five challengers, the best strategy that any of them has is to be almost as forgettable as possible so as to get to polling day without too many scandals emerging about them. The point of the presidential campaign is that when you run, you are basically putting a target on yourself. We saw this morning a slight mishap for Joan Freeman with all of the papers pulling up some details on the dodgy business practices of one of her, a person who lent her 120,000. I think that Sean Gallagher had a bit of a mistake trying to equal himself to Michael Dee and making him seem presidential. It actually meant he just missed out on an opportunity in these studios yesterday to set out his case. I think Leah probably made a mistake by telling Anya Lawler, one of the best journalists in the country, that she'd got her facts wrong, only for someone on Twitter to pull up the clip a couple of moments later. And I mean, going through the candidates, probably the most successful person this week was Gavin Duffy, because I almost forgot he was running, which in this campaign is almost a success.
Ellen Coyne. Despite calls by President Higgins for a respectful campaign, if the shenanigans during other presidential elections are anything to go by, this too promises to be a feisty campaign, with every personality foible and professional decision made by the election hopefuls picked over and judged. Martin Machen played a major role in Mary McAleese's presidential campaign. Bride Rosny masterminded Mary Robinson's. They joined Sean O'Rourke in studio on Wednesday.
There's one national constituency, the entire country. I mean, how does a candidate plan? I mean, just even the physical arrangements, they're important.
Yeah, well, you have to get your, and I'm assuming all the candidates who are serious about this have their campaign structures in place, they have the logistics in place, they have their team in place, they have a tour organised, because, you know, notwithstanding the importance of social media, there's still a very important old school flesh pressing aspect to this campaign. So all of those logistics will have to be in place. That's the raw machinery that's essential for a campaign. It's what happens after that's in place and the campaign actually starts, and where the campaign can take all kinds of twists and turns. Yeah,
so one debate down, and we've been told to expect at least another six media debates over the next month. And as we've seen in the past, these encounters are not for the faint-hearted.
Well, it depends on what your position is as a candidate. If you are the front runner, you will want to minimise your interaction with debates and want to stay out of them as much as possible. I think there's a challenge for Michael Dee here in managing to appear presidential and above the fray, but not seeming remote, distant or taking anything for granted. So I think he'll have to participate in at least one debate. And then for people who are coming from behind, if I can use that term, it's in their interest to get into a debate and frame themselves
but
in the context.
Why would Michael Dee, of all people, Martin, and I'll come to Brian on this in a moment, why would he, of all people, want to participate in only one debate?
It depends what approach you take to a campaign. If you take a safety first approach, and debates, as we know, are forums in which things happen. Mm. And there's an old and rather unlovely saying, I think, in American politics about entering a debate. You don't want to wrestle with a pig because you both get dirty and the pig likes it. If you're in front position, you have to be very, very wary of going into debate. It depends. Michael Dee, I think, is a very singular and independent minded individual. Mm. And if he wants to do all the debates, he will do all the debates. But I suspect some of his people will be suggesting, take it handy here.
And if you were advising President Higgins, Bride Rosny, would you share Martin's analysis?
I do. To be honest, I think the incumbent has more to lose than anybody else. It is advantageous for all the other candidates because there isn't the same name recognition, despite some of them having quite a strong profile in a particular programme, but there is not the same name recognition as there is for the incumbent. And I think Michael Dee has done a remarkable job as president, and he needs to stay presidential.
It's a month-long campaign now from here on in. I mean, how grueling is it for the candidate? To what extent do you have to adjust the times and the plans and all the rest of it, taking account of the need to keep him or her fresh?
That's a huge difficulty. Now, to be honest, my own direct experience was worse in that it was a 6 month campaign almost. And I think it is terribly important. You only have one candidate. You can have all the machinery you like behind it. But at the end of the day, you have one person out front. And the last thing you want is somebody going on screen or on radio when they're not ready for it, because they're too exhausted mentally and physically. So I think, you know, there's huge responsibility. And I think most campaigns, you have what Martin referred to as the raw machinery is well set up. But you also have a very tight kitchen cabinet. And they actually control the exposure, and they're the important people.
I couldn't agree with that more. I mean, and it's an exceptionally grueling campaign because the entire mantle of the campaign rests on the shoulders of one person. Even if there is a party structure there, though in this campaign there is only, in a sense, one formally active party structure. And I think there's a real onus on the campaign management team. They have a duty of care to their candidate to mind them, because if you have somebody going into a debate who's exhausted after, you know, maybe he's canvassing on a bridge in Dublin at 7 o'clock in the morning, going right through the day and then rocking out to a TV studio in the evening, they're going to be banjaxed.
Martin Machen and Bride Rosny on the grueling reality of a presidential campaign with Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. Ever since she was a child, 18-year-old Rebecca Carter from Wexford has been mad about animals and always knew she wanted to be a vet. But this week, she had to lawyer up to fight her case in the High Court when she was denied a place in UCD because a mistake was made totting up her marks in a Leaving Cert exam. Rebecca spoke with Mary Wilson after she'd won her High Court appeal.
You did your Leaving Cert 2 years ago. And you missed out by 12 points and you went back to study again.
So I repeated myself and I studied at home for the year. So I repeated this year then, and when I went to review my scripts, I seen the obvious totting up error.
Because when the results came in, you were short, was it 1 point?
First round, I was short 6 points.
Okay.
And then the second round, I was short by 1 point.
1 point.
So then I went and looked at my papers and I seen the clear mistake that had been made. So in one of the questions... On the business paper, yeah. There was three subtotals, 17, 19 and 30. He or she, the examiner, added those figures up to 56, but they add up to 66. So those 10 marks resulted in me getting a H2, whereas I should have gotten a H1.
Now, when you did that tot, did you go, great, I'm okay?
To be honest, I didn't. Everyone else was ecstatic, but I was still quite nervous, still because I didn't have my offer.
But did you think it would be simply a case of contacting the examinations board and the error would be corrected?
Oh, yes.
Because it didn't require a review of your papers. It didn't require for an examiner to go through your papers again. It was a simple accounting error.
Yeah, exactly. It was simply just a calculation error. It was nothing to do with the quality of my answers. So we thought we'd ring the SEC, tell them about my error. They'd get their calculator out, change the error, and I would have been starting in UCD not 3 weeks late.
Instead of that, they told you you'd have to wait until when?
The 10th of October.
And by then, what was the problem with your course?
By then, it would be too late to start in UCD, as last year they brought in a new policy where they don't accept students past the 30th of September.
It's a fairly big decision to decide to go to the High Court.
Yes, it is. We thought that the SEC would be able to change the error quickly. But then after 4 days of phone calls back and forth, we sought legal advice. And the following morning, I was signing my affidavit in the High Court.
And today you got a judgment in your favour. What does this mean?
Well, it means that the SEC will have to correct my paper. They'll correct the error that was made, and hopefully I'll be offered my place in UCD on Friday. So I'll start on Monday morning.
And the good news is that Rebecca will begin her studies in veterinary medicine at UCD next Monday. And the judge's ruling will also have implications for other students, as RTE's education correspondent Emma O'Kelly told Anya Lawler.
People around the country have been so oppressed by Rebecca Carter's resilience and the light she has shone on an issue that has been a problem for students year after year after year.
Yes, there's huge public sympathy and praise for Rebecca Carter. But yes, this has very wide ramifications. The State Examinations Commission was almost immediately saying that this was very significant, because the judge also said that the entire appeal system was, as he put it, manifestly unfit for purpose. And he ordered the Minister for Education, the Department of Education, to get this sorted by next year so that no other student is in the position that Rebecca Carter is in. So the big question is what to do. It looks as if the appeals process will have to be done faster. Now, that's a very big ask, mm-hmm. because one of the problems is the teachers who correct these papers, they're back at school by September. So that slows the whole process down. There are issues around pay. Teachers say, well, it's not worth their while doing the work because they're paid so low. But one option certainly will be that the State Examinations Commission will have to employ many more teachers to get this done faster. The State Examinations Commission is meeting meeting to look at all this today. They will issue a statement after that meeting. The Minister for Education, interestingly, has asked for a meeting with not only the State Examinations Commission, but also with the higher education institutions, because they clearly have a role to play here as well. They're the ones who set the deadlines. This has to be addressed.
From the News at One yesterday, well, Bliain na Gaeilge is well underway, and 2FM presenter Owen McDermott is behind a wonderful Conor na Gaeilge project called Ceol 2018, which features big songs and big names to promote the Irish language. 350,000 copies of the album have been distributed to students around the country, and Owen was Marion Finucane's guest last Saturday.
Tell me your history with Irish, so to speak.
Well, I've got Dublin schools Irish, born and raised in Dublin, so I'm not a native speaker, but Mam is now retired, but she was an Irish teacher. And I guess in school, I never really gravitated toward like any of the STEM subjects, but kind of had a bit of an aptitude for languages. But I guess that like my French should be terrible, but my Irish was lovely. And I kind of thought back on why that was. And it's because I went to the Gaeltacht, is the long and short of it. And it's just having an experience of Irish outside of the classroom, because I guess a lot of people have, it's lazy, but they have a negative experience with Irish in school, and that bleeds on into later life. And it was just exactly that, living it outside of like a structured environment. And I don't think I've ever met, because I went to the Gaeltacht as a student, as a Coontour, as a Kinnera, and then I did my degree in Irish and UCD and did a couple of years as a Moontour there. And I've never met any kid who's gone to the Gaeltacht and left hating the language.
It's a fair point. Tell us what you're in about, first of all.
Well, the album is called Ceol. It's been on the go. Conor na Gaeilge have done a version of this album for years, but they came to me 3 years ago and said, look, we'd like to collaborate and make it bigger and attract bigger artists and international artists. And so the last 2 years we've given out 50,000 copies, and this year we said, let's go hell for leather. It's Bliain na Gaeilge. So like you said, every secondary school student.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's we're really proud of it. And the calibre of artists we've attracted this year, we're also very proud of.
Tell me.
Macklemore is a big American rapper, urban artist, Grammy Award winner. Himself and Saoirse Ronan have teamed up to do like a spoken word introduction. It's kind of just a meditation on what the language is and what it means to people. I've asked Macklemore for 3 years. He's always said no, but he's got loads of Irish roots and he's very proud of them. So we hustled very hard and eventually he said yes, he's in there. Picture This have exploded. A lot of Irish people will know them by name. Codaline, The Coronas, Gavin James. There's some names people might necessarily recognise, but the songs themselves, JP Cooper is an artist, a UK-based artist who's done a song called September Song, and that song alone has 500 million streams.
And he will sing it, well, he has sung, because we're going to play it now, aren't we? He sings it, As Gaeilge.
Yeah.
On shash nor a vi mid le keila, le keila. Near bris you agree ha a rigon. Via merco sin in ta story. Ala wets galua em watching, le keila.
2FM's Owen McDermott, heard on the Marion Finucane show. And I only wish I had time to play you I'm Just a Teenage Dirtbag Baby, sung by Wheatus, As Gaeilge. It's just fab. Catriona Lally has an interesting backstory. She spent 4 years studying English at Trinity College in Dublin. After graduating, she got a job, but was then made redundant and decided to return to her old alma mater, this time as a cleaner. As she told Ryan Tubberty, it's a job she loves as it gives her time and the headspace to write and to look after her baby daughter, Alice.
Typically, what's the working day for a cleaner in Trinity?
It's 6 to 9:30. So it's 3.5 hours early morning, which is brilliant for a writer. You're in and out early and it's physical work, so there's no stress. I really enjoy it. It works well with my life.
Did you find it peculiar having been a student in the corridors, in the classrooms, in the lecture halls, and now you're the person who cleans them? And that's not meant in any way as a disrespectful comment about cleaners, but just in terms of the big leap that you make from student to worker.
Yeah, like you definitely see the place very differently. I think because I had worked there for summers, you know, it wasn't as big a shock to me, but you just see a whole other world. I mean, it's kind of magical at 6 o'clock. I work in the museum building, which is a really old building, and it's just gorgeous. And it's empty at that time. You're on your own in these old rooms, and it's a pretty cool place. Then when the students come in kind of from 9 o'clock, it becomes this whole other world. It's just, you're almost invisible. It's this weird thing of, yeah, if you're wearing that blue smock, that, you know, not everyone is friendly or acknowledges you. But
well, that's what I was going to ask you. When you're wearing the blue smock and others arrive in, do you feel there's an equality deficit among the corridors?
Only with some people. Like, there'd be lecturers and admin staff who'd all say good morning and who, you know, who'd know you by name. You know, a lot of students say good morning, but some don't. And I find that really strange. If you're in an empty lecture hall cleaning it, and then a student comes in, and I'd automatically say good morning to anyone. And if they just kind of look at you, I do find it strange. I don't, but now that's a minority of people. I wouldn't be judging all students, and people are in their own worlds too. It's not necessarily a comment on anything.
Do you like your job?
I really do, yeah. I have zero stress. In other jobs, sometimes I'd have dreaded going to work on Monday, but I've never dreaded going to work. And I have great colleagues, they're good crack. And it's just the perfect balance with writing.
On Wednesday, it was announced that Katrina had won the Rooney Prize for Emerging Writers and was awarded a big fat cheque of €10,000.
If this is the Rooney Prize, which people remember the late American ambassador Dan Rooney, who was here for 3 years, 09 to 12, and he obviously sponsored this prize. Tell me about the phone call you got to say this had come through.
Oh, it was the best day. Yes, Jonathan Williams, the chairman of the judges, and it was on a Monday. And on a Monday, Alice doesn't go to creche. So I am kind of rushing home after work to mind her for the day. And she's not a good sleeper. She prefers to play all day. So I was trying to put her down for a nap that day, and it wasn't happening. And we were both getting cranky. And then I got this call to say, you've won the Rooney. And I was so completely taken aback, and it was out of context. I just kind of thought, what's a Rooney? I had no idea what it was. And then Jonathan explained, and it was just brilliant. It turned into a fantastic Monday.
And the €10,000 that you won as part of the prize is, you know, you probably haven't spent in your head. But what are you going to treat yourself, or is it all going to be more practical than that, or what's the plan?
Oh, I wish I could be more exciting, but yeah, it's definitely just more practical, mundane stuff, paying off bills, put aside for creche, and the most exciting thing, a water tank for the attic.
That's yes.
Living the dream.
How long have you been waiting for that? It's happening, Katrina. The water tank
is
coming home.
It's all going on.
Katrina Lally is heard on The Ryan Tubridy Show. The book, Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling, is laugh out loud funny. It details the life of a very sensible girl called Aisling, a sort of Irish everywoman with impeccable culture credentials. And it started out as a Facebook group curated by Sarah Breen and Emer MacLeisett before it shot up the bestseller charts. Well, their latest book, The Importance of Being Aisling, Take Me Home, Country Roads, is now at number one, and it's not even Christmas. Aisling's creators, Emer and Sarah, joined Radar on Tuesday.
Yeah, she's with John.
She's working in Pensions Plus.
Yeah.
She is at the start of the book.
And living with Sive and Elaine.
Yes, the Notionsy friends in Portobello with the avocados and the wine fridge. Yeah.
And brunch.
Yeah. Yes,
So they have avocado on toast then regularly.
Oh yeah, but Aisling can't understand the avocado because so many Weight Watchers points. Why would you do it?
It's a fruit, for the love of God. It should be free.
But she's coming around to the idea of brunch.
Right.
She has no choice, really. You can't get a lunch in Dublin at the weekend.
Can't get chips at like 12 o'clock.
Yeah, and she's no Notions is Aisling. Like, for example, you know, is it cupcakes or buns? It'll always be buns.
It's buns.
Yes, yeah.
Like this cupcake nonsense, they're buns.
Right.
Catch a hold of yourself.
And what else would she be intolerant of?
What are Aisling? She rejects Notions in all their forms.
Yeah, she really does. People dyeing their hair grey. So there's a trend among young women to dye their hair a kind of a silvery purple grey. And it's very trendy. It looks very nice. But to Aisling, it's like, why would you dye your hair grey? I don't understand.
Yeah.
She has noticed that a lot of the garden centres around the country are starting to gather Notions at a great momentum.
What sort of things are they doing?
Brunch.
Hot tubs.
Oh, brunch.
They're putting in pumpkin patches for Halloween. These types of things, these American trends.
Yeah. Right.
So she abhors all that kind of stuff. She'll just about tolerate a baby shower because that's kind of a girls getting together thing, but she's not here for gender reveal parties. Yeah.
No. Who would?
So they just flesh out that then.
So it's mostly an American thing. So couples who are pregnant or whoever find out the gender of their baby in front of family and friends by kind of
you can get like a bakery to bake a cake with the pink or blue inside the cake, and the couple don't know until the cake is cut into.
So what, the doctor writes it on a piece of paper, they stick it into an envelope, and then they give it to some baker to put it into the cake.
Yeah.
They bring the cake home, they invite their friends around, and then they, wow.
Yeah,
because and there's other things as well. They'll shoot a hole in a balloon and confetti will come out of it, pink or blue confetti. Right.
Like if you search gender reveal parties on Instagram or Twitter, the things you will see will just blow your mind, but it's a bit much.
Emer McLysett and Sarah Breen in conversation with Ray Darcy. There's something very romantic and magical about living in a lighthouse. Mayo man Jerry McSweeney is a former lighthouse keeper, and he features in a new TV series which begins tomorrow night on RTE called The Great Lighthouses of Ireland. He was Ryan's guest on Thursday.
When you hear the word seascape, every time you go by the sea, as I would do pretty much every day for a walk, it's like walking through and living in a painting.
It is.
Except that it moves like a Harry Potter film.
It moves and changes every hour. Yeah, and the colours and the light.
Colours.
And even, you know, people love to walk it on a calm day, but there's also beauty in a rough day. The waves rolling in on the shore and listening to the noise, listening to the gulls.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
When you were in the lighthouse business, what was the night that you were most terrified?
Oh, the night I was most terrified was the night in 1986. I think the month was November on Eagle Island Lighthouse, just off Balmullet. And we had the tail end of a hurricane coming across the Atlantic. We knew from Medhearn the forecast was bad, so we battened everything down. We were in our accommodation block and the seas started coming over Eagle Island. Now, a lot of people will see waves with white water. It wasn't like that at all on Eagle Island that night, I can tell you. It was heavy green sea.
Right.
And they'd come up over a 200-foot wall, the wave, and it would come over the accommodation block. And actually inside in the block, you could feel the pressure in your ears of the air being compressed down. And then after a second or 1.5 seconds, splash everywhere, water running everywhere. And that night, that particular night, the storm or the hurricane knocked out the navigation light. And it also knocked down a big radio beacon aerial down across our engine room.
Yeah.
We still had power, funny enough, the generators stayed running. And we were in touch with our inspector in Dublin. I think it was Captain Gray at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he did ask, did we want to be evacuated by chopper? But a chopper wouldn't get near Eagle Island on that night. But we stuck it out till morning and the storm abated. And we were delighted. And I said to myself, the first thing I'll do when I hit the mainland is I'm going to confessions before I come out here again.
Really? Was it that
It was that bad. It was. That was the only night I ever thought of my mortality.
Jerry Sweeney with Ryan Tuberty on Thursday. The management of the Setanta Hurling GAA Club in Ballymun in Dublin recently wrote an open letter saying that it couldn't field a minors team as it's losing so many of its members to drug gangs. So, Today reporter Evelyn O'Rourke visited the club on Tuesday, where the manager of the under-15s, Janice, described the problems.
You're looking around and you can see some kids that might have been involved hanging around the weekends, drinking, smoking weed and selling, which is disgusting.
So that talent and energy gone?
The talent we've lost is unbelievable. Did easily make senior squad and then go on to trial for Dublin.
So what, the older guys who are involved in drugs, get the younger guys in?
A hunter and it's prey.
The pattern is what?
The pattern is like they're looking at the older fellas going around in their brand new tracksuits. Do a delivery for me and I'll get you your brand new Nikes, or you can get the new iPhone 7 or whatever is out now.
The bit that I think drives you mad is the hanging around thing.
Yeah. You see the older young fellas going over because the minors, that's the way they think. They won't get arrested. Get away from the kids. Just leave them alone. Just let them be kids. I am the worst nightmare for them. I'm in their ears constantly. Like even if I'm in the shops and I see them, I'm like, what are you doing? Who are you with? Get your ass home. There's no escape. I'll catch them everywhere.
Evelyn O'Rourke reporting for the Today Show on Tuesday. The Dublin History Festival started last Monday and runs until next weekend, with 140 free events taking place in venues all over the capital. Well, one of those venues is the city's newest museum, 14 Henrietta Street, and Lorcan Clancy took the tour with guide Tracy Barden for the History Show.
You're all very welcome to 14 Henrietta Street. The street was built by a man called Luke Gardner in 1740.
That's our guide, Tracy Barden, beginning a tour of the newly opened museum.
You would come up the street in the horse and carriage, along the cobbles, and you would enter the front door and up a grand staircase.
The Georgian townhouse takes you on a journey through almost three centuries of social history, from the privileged lives of Dublin's aristocratic elite to the overcrowded tenements of the city's working poor.
We tell two sides, the Georgian side from the 1700s up until the 1970s when the last tenants of the tenement area left the house. It's very rare that just the general public would get to see the size and the splendour of a Georgian house. So they're quite in awe at the beginning, and sometimes when they come in, they're fairly quiet. But as we go through the house and we talk about the history and they learn a little about what happened here, they come alive and they come chatty, and it's nice to see the smiles on people's faces as they go from room to room.
It was the late 19th century when number 14 was split into tenements, which housed multiple families, often in appalling conditions where diseases thrived.
There's no point in sugarcoating history, because then you forget what happened. So when people see the dark side of the history, it just gives them a minute to stop and think and reflect about where their ancestors have come from. And it wasn't too long ago.
Lorcan Clancy reporting for The History Show last Sunday evening. Well, the inaugural RTE Radio 1 Folk Awards will take place in Vicar Street, Dublin on the 25th of October, and Andy Irvine, one of music's creative geniuses, will be honoured with the Lifetime Achievement Award. Now in his 70s, Andy has never tired of the road and is still gigging and collaborating with the likes of Paul Brady and Donal Lunny. But on Second Captains Live, he recalled his time as a founder member of the supergroup Planxty with Christy Moore, Donal Lunny and the late great piper Liam O'Flynn.
The way you describe it now, Andy, it sounds like nothing too dramatic. Planxty breaks up, you just keep doing what you're doing with somebody else. Is that the way it always was for you? Something ends, you got to keep going, you got to make your living, you got to do your thing?
Well, yes, basically that was it, yeah. But I mean, the thing about Planxty breaking up was that we'd all had enough at that point, because it wasn't just, as bands are these days, a tour on when it's on and not on when it's not on. This was a full-time occupation. We were in that bloody van week in, week out. And eventually we had no time to get anything new together, because we were just traveling so much and playing in Europe. So when, God bless him, when Liam, may he rest in peace, called the meeting, we knew what it was about. And as soon as he said, I'd like to leave the band, we all chorused, yes, me too.
Really, everyone was waiting to go, yeah.
You know, the first 18 months of Planxty was divine. It was, we hadn't expected the success, we hadn't expected the fame. We loved it, because it was unexpected, especially. I mean, there is a recording of the Cork gig on the first tour where we supported Donovan, where after every number, the audience just goes berserk. And all you can hear from the people on the stage is this hysterical giggling. And the humour, you know, like Christy and Donal especially, where they were always funny.
Andy Irvine with Owen McDevitt. But I leave you now with a song from Andy, who played live on Second Captains. Gramahagovas for Goluther, Tasulam Gurwanshev, Saltasaglor, Agiskameshev Lom, Taka and Amikiana, on Tachtan Johugin, Gijishin, Gijeshab Slan.
A round of applause, please, for the brilliant Andy Irvine.